This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Future CEOs. My name is Gareth Armstrong. It's so good to be with you today. As per usual, we're bringing in really what are business superstars into studio and talk to them about their journeys. How did they do what they do? And what are we trying to do with on the Future CEO show? We're trying to help you expedite the growth of either your business or your career. You may have that your eye on that corner office. We want to help you do that. Or maybe you're ready to scale that business. We want to help you do that as well. That's what we do here on Future CEOs. We bring the best and brightest into studio. We ask them to share some of their highs, some of their lows. We learn from them. Ian, you're one of the people that we absolutely know we're going to be able to learn from. Welcome to the Future CEOs show and Cliff Central.
Hi, thanks very much, Gareth. I appreciate being here today and thanks for inviting me.
Ian, it's no mistake that you're here because you are what I think I'm going to have to call a retail icon, magnate, serial retailer.
Serial is probably better than magnate and icon and all that stuff. Well, serial, it just means that I've done it a few times.
Yeah. You've done it a few times. You've probably learned a number of lessons along the way.
Correct.
I want us to explore that. But before we get into all of that detail, as we do here on Future CEOs, we're always interested to see how guests introduce themselves. Ian, welcome. Tell everyone who you are and give us a little bit of background. Tell us why you're here.
Right. So my name is Ian Furr. I suppose I can call myself a serial entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur since I was 22 years old, and I've been doing that now for 43 odd years. So I've had a bit of experience in that. And my life has been littered with a number of startup companies over the years. The good, the bad, and the ugly, but I've learned from all of them. And towards the end of your life, as you start growing, you start to put all the lessons together that you've learned over the years from the various businesses. And that when I started Sorbet, it was trying to put all of those into one business, one final shot at an entrepreneurial venture, basically.
And what a shot it's been. Congratulations on the success Sorbet has been. I do want to talk to you about that. Just by the way, it's an absolute honor having you here. And in honor of you being here, downstairs in the other studio, we have a jazz band playing. So if anyone's hearing background noise, it's an honor of you.
If I break into song, you won't mind.
No, not at all. It will be a unique, one-time-only experience on Future CEOs, I think. Ian, let me read something that was written about you by a journalist, which I believe is probably the right way to start the conversation. Here it is. When Ian Furr made the decision to launch the Sorbet Beauty Chain in 2004, almost everyone he spoke to thought he was either pulling their leg or experiencing a break with reality. That's an interesting thing to have said about someone. They're breaking with reality.
Yes, I think what I was trying to do at the time seemed a little odd to most people because I had left my previous company and I was looking for something to do. And when I started to tell people that the idea would be to start a beauty salon chain that would hopefully one day be a national household name, I think there was, a few people that looked at me weirdly, especially my wife at the time and my family, who could not understand what I was trying to do. I knew nothing about the beauty industry whatsoever. I think those type of things, perhaps they've inspired me over the years, is when people say it can't be done. That really says...
Well, actually...
That's right. It says to me, okay, well, let's go and try at least, give it your best shot to... That's what I did.
It's interesting. So there's a couple of different points here that let's talk about. First, often someone that's associated with a beauty salon is not an older gentleman. It's rather it's rather a young lady who has some kind of technical expertise in that world, in the beauty industry. Where did this come from?
Okay, so I had sold my previous company, which is called Supermart, to Edcon in 2003, and I was looking for something to do, and I happened to be lying on a massage table, believe it or not.
Okay.
That was a proper professional massage, in case you have any other ideas. and the beauty therapist who was doing the massage said to me, "Why don't you look at the beauty industry?" She had been involved in the industry for quite a while, and she was trying to explain to me that there was a gap in the market. I asked her if there was a market in the Gap, and she said, well, you know, why don't you try and find out? I said, well, I couldn't see myself in the beauty industry, quite frankly. I just couldn't see my face on a billboard advertising beauty, because we were trying, you know, attract women into the stores rather than chase them away. And I said to her, you know, I know nothing about beauty. I don't know about products. I don't use any products. I use soap once or twice a week. And stuff like that. And she said, never mind all that. You understand a little bit about business. Why don't you find out if there's an opportunity in this market? And I did. I went and had a look. And the one thing that I discovered was that there wasn't a single branded chain of beauty salons in South Africa. And that was really what inspired me at the time. I thought, okay, this is something we have to do. I couldn't understand why there wasn't one. And I knew that somewhere along the journey I was going to find out, probably the hard way. But I thought, well, this is an exciting thing. And one of the things about being an entrepreneur, particularly for me, is I always enjoyed going into a new industry each time I started a new
business. Really? Okay.
Yeah, because I felt that if you grow up in a particular industry and you're trying to start something new, you kind of get contaminated by the rights and wrongs of that industry, what works, what doesn't. And I prefer to always come in with fresh eyes and say, okay, well, I'm not going to listen to what people tell me about this industry. I'm going to do it and find out for myself. And I think that's always helped me quite a lot because it gave me an advantage because I knew nothing, quite frankly. So,
yeah, you were able to ask very different questions.
That's correct. Yeah. Ignorance in this case was an advantage for me.
What's so interesting is often what we experience is we learn that there are multiple types of entrepreneurs that exist. And so some are really good at starting businesses. Some are really good at growing business. And others are really good when it comes to massive scale. You seem to then, in your journey, have started multiple businesses, taken them all through various phases of business. How is it that you have been able to do that? How did you know where your skills lay?
Okay, that's an interesting question, and I've asked myself that a few times as well. I think that I've recognized the things that I'm good at or what I enjoy, really, and that's starting something. Trying to challenge the status quo of an industry, trying to do something that never been done before. Those are the things that you know, that excite me, I believe. And then once a business is up and running and it's getting to scale, then I'm not that interested, quite frankly, in the detail anymore.
Sure.
And the operational side of the business. And then I get a bit itchy and start looking for something new. So and try and sell the business wherever possible, or sometimes even close it down and just move on. I mean, that's just the thing that I believe it's always been for me is the opportunity to build a brand and to start something new and different that's never been done before.
The brand, I heard clearly that the brand in Sorbet is probably the linchpin or the gold in the middle. I want to get back into that, but let's talk a little bit about you and your journey first. Right. So what you discovered is that you like to, let's call it attack the status quo.
Correct.
Take it head on. Yes. What is the difference between taking on the status quo, interrogating it, and then this idea of innovation? Why are you successful, but other people who brand themselves as innovators aren't as successful?
I think that's a tough one. I'm not quite sure if I'm an innovator. I think I've just had certain ideas about business that I've tried to implement over the years. So it's a combination, really, of the brand, of building a brand, and more importantly, building a corporate culture, which is the thing that I'm most passionate about. And then trying to put some ideas together. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But to try and be as different as possible, that's always the key for me. So when I went into the beauty industry, for example, I looked at what was available. I mean, each thing that I tried to do, including the choice of the name and everything else, was to be different from the rest of what was out there at the time.
Yeah.
So that's really, I think, the thing for me was differentiation as much as possible.
How did you discover this bug, this thing inside of you? Let's call it entrepreneurship. Back then it probably wasn't called that. It wasn't necessarily fashionable. How did you discover it? What was your first entrepreneurial thing that happened?
I was quite fortunate in that my father was one of the founding directors of Russell Furnishes, the furniture business. And so we used to sit around. I'm the youngest of five children. My older brother was also an influence. He was 11 years older than me. He was in business before me. So So we used to sit around the dinner table, and there were lots of things that they spoke about. It was mainly business. And my father was a marketing man, and he used to teach us some sort of, you know, marketing principles. So I learnt around the dinner table, I think, was the first thing. And I think I was fortunate to be able to have that as an opportunity, because not everybody gets to do that.
So listening very carefully is...
Particularly to someone who has a lot of wisdom and experience, you know. So, and then, of course, I went to school. And then some things happened at school that changed my view on life, particularly insofar as sort of discrimination and issues that were relating to apartheid at the time. I was pretty naive. I was taken to a Jewish school because I was Jewish, and my parents put me there. I'm still not quite sure why, but anyway, they did. And the thing about going to a Jewish school was that there are only Jews there, so I never got an opportunity to meet anyone else or to interact with people of other religions and cultures and races and stuff like that, which in hindsight was actually, I think, a disadvantage for me. But one of the things that comes out of that type of thing is when you're sort of ring-fenced and you're insular in your upbringing, is that you start to believe, we started to believe that, and we were told that the Jews were the chosen people of God. And, you know, being young and naive, you just accept that and you carry on living your life. And then I went into the army at the end of all that, and there I met a different group of people, which was Afrikaans-speaking Christian males. And I thought that I'd been chosen by God, of course, and I can tell you they didn't think so at all.
Oh, wow.
they thought that I was something completely different, and they told me exactly what they thought about me and Jewish people. And then they said, well, they were, in fact, the chosen people of God. And so that was a hell of an experience for me, as a bit of a dilemma as a 17-year-old boy. And from kind of hero to zero, I think you can say, one day I thought I had been chosen, I was special, I was better than everyone else, and the next day I was at the bottom of the heap.
How did you cope with it?
Well, I struggled, I think, a bit. And then I think eventually, and I'm not quite sure exactly when it happened, but I came to the realization that there is no chosen people of God. There is no one group that is superior or inferior to another, and that we're all just different. And the sooner we learn to accept and tolerate and understand our differences, the better off our country would be. And that set a bit of a platform for me, because then I got involved in a number of other things where the racial issues and apartheid and all of those things became a part of my life. And I think it also laid a good platform for me in business, because I think I had some sort of an understanding of how to manage people, particularly of diverse backgrounds. So that was an important thing for me.
And that's such a big thing. You spoke about something that's near and dear to your heart, which is building a certain kind of culture within a business. Okay. And so I hear that this is where this is coming from.
This is an integral part of it.
Yeah. So just in a nutshell or two, a lesson or two that all of our future CEOs on this point can take away from that experience for you in the army, and what perhaps some of the principles that you incorporate now as you build businesses, what are they around this idea of diversity and cultural integration and similar?
Well, I think if you look at my first business, which was called Kmart, it was a retail chain. Just to give you a little bit of background there, my older brother had been to America, and he came back and he liked the idea of large retail chains.
Which they're very good at there.
Yeah, and particularly the one called Kmart in the States. And so he said, we should open one. And I was 22. That was our first business.
Oh, wow.
And I decided, okay, well, all right, let's give it a bash. Being very naive and not understanding issues of trademarks and things, I just called it Kmart as well. You know, didn't think about registering or finding out.
Okay, so I mean, here I am. I'm thinking, how did you, as a 22-year-old, get a license from it? But actually, what you're saying?
No, we didn't total, ask. We just
total ripoff.
Total ripoff. And to make things worse, we actually used their logo as well.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so that was really dumb.
That's naivety, right?
total naivety. No idea. I'd never been in business before. But then we opened this thing, and it was aimed at the black market per se. And of course, all the staff were black and the customers were all black. And I was the only white person essentially in the whole business at that time. So I had to learn pretty fast if I was going to be able to work together with these people and understand the different cultures and backgrounds and things like that. So I was thrown a bit in the deep end. And then a few sort of examples of things happened to me. One of them, which was pretty interesting actually, was at the time there were some consumer boycotts going on in South Africa of white-owned businesses. And one of my guys who was like my star supervisor, the guy that I had really identified as future potential.
Yeah, this is the rising star.
This is the rising star. He got caught handing out these pamphlets on the corner of our store there, you know, handing out pamphlets and promoting a consumer boycott of white-owned stores. So obviously I was completely wild. I mean, I called him in. I said, I mean, how can you do this to us? And I spoke to him like a father, you know, you can't do this. And he said, I'm sorry, Ian, but you need to understand that this work, I enjoy my work and I love coming to Kmart, but at the end of the day, in South Africa, life is pretty tough. So when I leave here, I get harassed by the police. And there's all kinds of things that go wrong. I never know from one day to the next if I'm going to be arrested for some or other apartheid law. And so for me, the struggle is really more important than my work. And that was one hell of an eye-opener for me. So instead of firing him, I asked him to be my mentor and to take me into the townships and teach me about what was really going on.
Very nice.
In South Africa. So that was an important lesson for me. And then we worked closely together until very sadly he was murdered about three or four years later. So that was quite sad.
The Kmart story, where did it end? So at what point did Kmart head office say, hi, guys. Yes. We don't have record of a license.
That's right. 12 years later.
Oh, 12 years.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah, 1988. We opened up in 1976, which was right in the middle of the Soweto uprisings, in fact. And 1988, they came with an army of lawyers. And we tried to defend it, but we were up against it there, and they just smashed us. And we had to change our name to Supermart.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was the business that was eventually bought by Edcon
in
2003.
You've got this retail history. I think let's start talking a little bit about your business ethos and approach. Approach. So you've spoken about company culture.
Yes.
The Sorbet story has a brand around it. Let's start talking a little bit about it.
Okay, well, the brand has got two elements. One is the look and feel of the brand and how you present it out there and your marketing and your strategy. And the other is how the service works, you know, in terms of the people. So I've always tried to try and combine those if I can. But the people element has always been the big one for me. So we've got help, and my daughter, fortunately, she's our group marketing manager and she's done some amazing things for the brand. But as far as I was concerned, my key thing was building the culture. And in order to do that, the one lesson that I learned quite early on in my journey is that the purpose of work is not to make money. And that came as quite a shock to me at the time, and certainly quite a shock to the people that I was trying to manage in the business at the time.
Can you tell us that experience? How did that come about?
Okay, so there was a guy by the name, well, there is a guy, right? Still alive. His name is Jerry Skatermer. And he was an economic journalist, and he wrote a book or two, and I met him, and he told me that the purpose of work is not to make money, it's to serve people.
And did you reject that initially?
Well, I was fascinated by it. You know, it was something completely new and different, because everything up until then had always been about making money. And I thought success was about money and power and influence and fast cars and fast women. And,
what do you mean? Are you saying it isn't?
All of that. Now I have a very different view about that, of course, because now I believe that the success, you know, is best measured by the contribution you make to other people's lives. So people serving people is really the philosophy of our business. So if you have somebody that comes to work and they're only interested in themselves and in the money, we have a special name for them. We call them eye specialists.
Eye specialists.
Eye specialists, yeah. They specialize in themselves. And they need to understand that, you know, if they continue to be eye specialists in our environment, they won't be welcome, and we'll eventually ask them to leave.
Are eye specialists easy to spot?
Very, very much so, because they focus on themselves. Everything's about me. What's in it for me? So we try and work, and I do all the induction training myself. So every single person that ever comes through our business or joins our community, we call it a community, not a company, they have to come through my induction training, which is a one-day program. where I try and help everybody to understand the philosophy of the business. And the key to that philosophy is that the purpose of work is to serve people. And the higher purpose is to touch lives.
Mm.
That's what we're out there. And we try and explain to all of our citizens, we call our staff our citizens, and whether they are beauty therapists or nail technicians or hairstylists or barbers, it makes no difference, that their role and their purpose is to touch people's lives in a positive way.
Yeah, what's so interesting about what you're sharing right now and the conversation that I had probably about an hour ago with someone who understood that you were coming to studio was they really wanted insight on sales. So, and my view of top CEOs is that they're potentially some of the best salespeople in the world, some of the good ones anyway. But what you're describing is, I think, sales 101, but also 201, 301, because how many people out there are just pushing a product rather than serving other people, trying to solve their problems?
So serving people is the key. So if you're thinking about yourself and how much money you're going to make, then you're working on a job. But if you're serving people and you are trying to make a difference in their lives and touch their lives in a positive way, you know, it's no longer a job, it's a privilege, quite frankly, and you're on a mission. So we get all of our people to try and understand that. Not everybody gets it up front, but over time they start to understand that if they really serve well, that the money will come.
Exactly. That money is a byproduct of it. Yeah.
That's correct.
And a reward is a better way to say it,
Yeah. So, you know, if you serve well, money is the reward. And then they start to understand. And then what you find is that people start to change their attitude towards their work. And that's been, I think, perhaps our single biggest differentiator over the years is the attitude of our people. Because we don't offer anything dramatically different to what our competition does. You know, we do treatments like everyone else. We sell products. But I think at the end of the day, it's the attitude of our people that really makes a difference. Mm. And there are a number of things that have happened and examples over the years where I've been quite astounded by the relationships that have developed between our guests and our citizens and the stories that we get back from them. And I've just written a book recently called The Soul of Sorbet, which is going to be launched in July.
And okay, excellent.
A lot of those stories are in there, and perhaps I can share one or two with you.
Yeah, please.
So, for example, we received an email from a woman who had the traumatic experience of having to have a mastectomy, which is the loss of both breasts because of cancer.
Mm.
And during her recovery, she struggled to dry her hair or to even comb her hair because she couldn't lift her arm because of the muscles and the pain. So she came to our dry bar to have us do her hair for her.
Mm.
And then she sent us an email about a month later, saying to us that the staff there at that store actually saved her life and got her through this most traumatic experience. And she was coming there every 2 or 3 days. And it wasn't just the hair that they were doing, but it was the support and the encouragement and just helping her to get through this very traumatic experience. And those kind of stories have been coming through a lot lately, and people starting to understand that this is not just a business. It's a place where you go and you can develop relationships, and the attitude of the people makes all the difference.
Well, I don't know if our listeners picked up on what you said, but you were speaking about a relationship between your citizens, which you emphasized earlier, but what you didn't mention is that your customers are not called your customers, they're called
your
guests.
Yes,
and so that changes the dynamic entirely on how someone might treat another person coming through their doors.
Correct.
So what I'm hearing is a confirmation of what I suspected, which was brand and then customer centricity.
Correct.
And really wrapped or held together by the glue, which is a really strong corporate culture, a culture that by and large is directly driven by yourself, who does all the induction. That I think it shows all of us. It helps me to understand how important that is. And potentially the success that you've experienced as a result. There's another success factor that I'd like us to look at, which is you didn't start a service chain although you call them guests and you're there to serve, there was a tweak in the way that you approached the business, and this is to your strength, which is, I think, retail. And so you approached Sorbet with a retail business model rather than a service delivery model, which is often the massages and the care. But there was something that drove that, even through the cyclical periods that the beauty industry experiences.
Right. So I think that was part of our differentiation right from the beginning. And because of my retail experience, I decided to make it more of a retail environment, which offered treatments, than a beauty salon that sold a few products. So I think that was part of our differentiation sort of strategy at the time.
It's a fine line, and there's some nuances there. What are those nuances?
Well, I think on average, most beauty salons at the time would do about 70% of their turnover in treatments and about 30% in retail. We try to make it more 50-50.
Okay.
Because we felt that the retail opportunity was quite big. The treatments are great, but you're a bit limited by the number of treatment rooms and the number of citizens that you have. But retail, obviously, there's no limit.
So
we try to promote that, and we got some really strong brands to help us. We sort of built our business quite a lot on the back of two strong brands, Dermalogica and Environ Skincare, and that helped us quite a lot.
Okay, so part of your success was to partner with other brands.
Yes, these products were sold in many other stores at the same time, but we changed it slightly in that we had a big focus on the retail side. There were big displays, and people could see that we were serious about retail.
Okay, I see.
And we started to capture quite a large percentage of the market of those two brands.
So there was a very much a partnership.
Correct.
But using other people's products rather than
and
your
skills
own.
Skills and their training and all of the other good things that come with it.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So you're starting out on the Sorbet journey. What's the first step you do to actually qualify the opportunity? Because as you rightly asked, is there a market in the gap? How did you actually qualify this?
Okay, what I did was I bought up a couple of independent salons at the time, started in 2004 and into 2005, just so that we could learn the business and understand it a little bit. And then I think once we had a bit of a handle on it, we started to realize that the most important thing about building a brand of any kind, particularly if you're looking at a chain, is to get the consistency of service across the board. That's the biggest challenge by far. And that was the reason I believe that there are very few of these. And quite frankly, there are very few successful beauty salon brands in the world that have more than 200 stores like we have at the moment. So,
I've spent a fair bit of time with the local CEO and in the business. This is the McDonald's difference.
Yeah.
The fact that they can standardize the experience, standardize the product. This I learned 10 years ago, sitting with their head of HR. They have a university, McDonald's University, which is really the reason they're able to do all the standardization. Sounds like you're in charge of your university.
So we're copying them and we're starting the Sorbet University.
Oh, are you? Yes, okay, yes. Very interesting.
Yes, indeed.
So there's that differentiation that you're describing. What I'd like to do is then move a little bit into the journey, because it sounds peachy. It sounds like it was a bed of roses, because you've got so much experience.
Yeah.
What did you encounter along the way that were some challenges that you had to overcome? Can you share some of those experiences?
Yeah, well, the first 4.5 years we call the dark days because we
4.5 years.
4.5 years.
Not 1 year, not two years.
No, 4.5 years.
On the back of many, many other years of retail experience that you have.
Correct.
So this is important to note.
And correct. And the problem, of course, was the staffing part of the business. And that was what we experienced, was that I really struggled to get people to understand this philosophy of ours in the beginning, that the purpose of work was to serve, not to make money. Most people thought I was a bit nuts, quite frankly.
It's a tough pull to swallow.
Yes.
Certainly if you don't see the beginning from the end, perhaps.
Yeah. So we were hoping to franchise quite early in the life cycle, but we couldn't quite get there. We had to open eventually 22 company stores before we sold our first franchise. And it took us 4.5 years of losing money and having to put money into the business every single month without fail for 4.5 years.
It's difficult to justify that to partners and to potential shareholders.
And to yourself. You start to question your own sanity eventually. And so, yeah, I think it was getting quite close to a point where I wasn't quite sure that I could carry on. And then we managed to sell our first franchise. I think one of the stories that relates to selling the franchises was that there was this franchise expo that you go to and you set up your stand. And my partner, Rudy Rudolph, and I, two old guys, he's even older than me. Yeah, so we went there together to try and see if we could sell a few franchises.
A beauty franchise.
Yeah, yes. And we didn't actually get even one inquiry. It was quite sad.
Mm.
And we realized that none of the women were actually coming too close to us, to our stand. And I think at the end of the day, I thought they probably wondered what these two old perverts were doing, trying to attract women and maybe sell them in Thailand or something.
Oh, yeah.
So they kept a wide berth and they didn't come anywhere near us. So we had to change our strategy quite significantly at that time.
What was the change? What was that thing that turned it around?
Well, the first lesson was to get a female to be standing there because it was a beauty industry type organization.
Mm.
And that you don't sell franchises from expos. I think that was the big lesson.
Okay.
What we discovered is when we sold our first franchise, it was because a guest of ours loved the experience she was having in one of the stores, and she decided she wanted to own one. And subsequently to that, I think every single one of our franchisees now has been a guest first before they became a franchisee, and that really encouraged us because people love the brand and they love the experience.
Yeah, there's no kind of ratification that, like someone wanting to open a business exactly like your business because of their experience.
Yeah, and they become passionate, and we look for the passion. Really, I think that's even more important than the skills. In some cases, if you really love the brand, then you're going to make it work.
At that particular point, did you then say, "Well, we need to start marketing this opportunity internally"? Is that how it came about, or was it still just a very organic process?
We had been marketing, bits and pieces, and we'd have flyers, and of course on the website we'd put our franchising. But I think once the momentum started going, we hit that sort of tipping point, and then we started opening quite quickly, and then also selling off the company stores. Two franchisees, which helped us to get back onto a more solid financial sort of footing. And then after that, well, I suppose we never looked back after that.
So at that particular point, you begin to experience growth.
Yes.
Now, this is where a lot of entrepreneurs begin to struggle because they're really good at starting. You have said that this is potentially where you begin to lose a little bit of interest. Talk to us a little bit about your experience of taking in your environment. This is probably the wrong word, the total wrong word, but taking command of a big ship with a lot of citizens.
I think what helped me a lot in that process was I brought my family into the business.
So okay.
It's become a family business. Well, particularly now, until such time as we sold it recently to Long for Life, you probably know about that. So it was a family business for several years, and I've got three children, all of whom pitched in and made a big contribution. And of course, my other partners, Rudy and other people, Deborah Rosen and people that run the Cape, they started to contribute. And then all of a sudden, it started to work like a kind of a machine, really. Mm. It got a life of its own.
Yeah, like a flywheel effect of sorts, right?
Correct, yeah. So once we were comfortable that the franchisees were on board and they believed what we believed, that the purpose of work was to serve, and they believed in our higher purpose, and everyone started getting into that, it started to kind of work a little bit like a well-oiled machine. Mm. And the store openings became quite easy, actually. For the last 4 or 5 years, we've been opening about 30 stores per annum.
Wow.
And they all seem to go, quite smoothly with the new franchisees. Obviously, training became a massive part of the thing.
Mm.
And the consistency of service. So we want someone to go into a store in Polokwane and experience the same kind of service and attitude as if they went into a store in Sea Point in Cape Town. So that was the biggest challenge, and still is our single biggest risk, is to maintain the consistency of service and the attitude of our people across the chain. And then it, you know, started, as I say, to take a life of its own, really.
We had a conversation a few years ago around family businesses and family-owned businesses. That's a challenge in and of itself, which is interesting. I think we're going to have you back on and talk us through how you were able to do that.
But I
want to dig into your leadership a little bit, if we can at this point. I'm fascinated by the different approaches of different leaders and how their emphasis is appropriate for different businesses at different times.
Yeah.
If I was to ask you, what are your three pillars of solid, good business leadership? What would they be?
Okay, so I build, you know, in terms of culture always is the foundation of a business.
Okay, absolute foundation.
Right. Okay, so the foundation and what we call the soul of Sorbet, and it's got four pillars as opposed to three.
Perfect.
And the first one is people before profits. So we always have to focus on people first, because if we don't get the people element of the business right, we're never going to make any money in any case. So it doesn't really matter.
I'm going to challenge you on that one because it sounds good. But how do you practically implement that, though, especially when you're under financial pressure?
Well, I think we've done that because, you know, if we look back at the dark days and when we were trying to climb out of a hole, we kept thinking, you know, if we try and make money and we cut our costs and we cut everything back, you know, it's not going to work. So we had to just keep believing that we're going to build a brand that somebody wants to buy one day. And in so doing, you had to have the people element of the business, right? So I always believe, and I still believe, and I know it sounds a bit airy-fairy and not many companies agree with it, but I still believe that if you really get the people element of your business right, the rest comes a lot easier. So if you focus on people before profit, it works. It certainly worked for me.
When I look at you, and we're going to get into the other pillars in a moment, but what I see is someone that's mature enough, and we're not talking about age, but mature enough to be able to realize that there are different stages, and at that particular point, we're going to profit, and we're going to profit in a big way as a result of a particular kind of focus.
Correct.
Rather than the instant
short-term focused sort of money-making proposition.
Okay, so that's pillar number one, people before profit, and you mean it. I know you mean it.
Yes, we definitely mean it.
Pillar number two?
Pillar number two is community building. Okay, so we need to build a community of the people, and that's some of the things that I mentioned earlier on about the diverse society. So we're working in a country like South Africa that's got a hell of a history behind it and is hugely diverse, and there's a lot of polarization even today still there, and there's, you know, you're working with people of different race groups and cultures and religions and political views and all of these different things. And if you don't actually work on that, or if you ignore it and hope that it doesn't affect you in any way, I think that's a bit naive. So we have to spend time on it, and that's one of the things that we do. So in the induction training and wherever else we can, we talk about the importance of understanding people that are different to you, accepting and respecting. You know, when Nelson Mandela came out of prison and he spoke about the Rainbow Nation, which sadly has kind of faltered a little bit over the years. But I've always believed that if we can't change the country, because we're obviously too small to do that, we can at least make some changes within our own community. So we call it a rainbow community, where people accept and respect and tolerate their differences. And once you have a strong community, I think the performance, I mean, we have proof over the years that the stronger the relationships within a store or a community of people, the better the performance is going to be. And the focus can then be on the guests as opposed to on each other and conflict and all of the things that undermine community. So we work hard on that.
It's a beautiful dovetail into your first point, your first pillar. I guess I can hear our listeners asking the question, but how do you still push a business forward while trying to please everyone? Because you can't please everyone. Yeah. Or maybe you can. Maybe you've found that secret sauce that we need. Address that issue of trying to please everyone, please.
Yeah, okay. So I think trying to please everyone is quite challenging, and I don't think we ever have pleased everyone. There's always going to be some people that can fall by the wayside. But the point here is that in business, you've got two elements. You've got the business side of it, which is the brand and the sales and the services you provide. And you have to get all of that right. Obviously, that's a given. But if you have a culture which lays the foundation for great customer service or guest service, as we call it. That is the key to it. So it's a combination of both. It's not one or the other. But I think the foundation needs to be in place. Otherwise, you're never really going to get the service that you want on the other side. So if people are comfortable within their environment, you know, people say to me, how do you motivate? We have about 3,000 citizens now across the country. How do you motivate 3,000 people? And I say, well, quite frankly, I don't motivate anybody because I don't believe you can motivate people. They have to motivate themselves. Mm. But what we try and do as leaders is we try and inspire people to motivate themselves and more specifically to try and create a working environment in which people feel comfortable and they feel confident and that they are prepared to follow you to places they may never have gone by themselves.
So I'm hearing a few things come out here, which is first, we have that foundation, that culture. Right. Now, what's interesting about culture is that there is an identity attached to culture as well.
Right.
And so while we're saying respect everyone, people that come into the business must respect the culture. And really what I'm hearing is that they must take the identity that is sorbet on themselves.
Correct.
And any of the sharp edges that they might have brought into the businesses will be absorbed by that culture and by taking on that new identity. I think I hear that.
Okay. It's part of a journey of self-discovery for a lot of people. Because they come in and they're being challenged on different things. And if you have some very inflexible paradigms about your views on life and on particularly about race and culture and religion and those type of things, then you're never going to be able to change. If you are blinkered, you're going to be an eye specialist, you're going to believe that yours is the best way and the only way and the right way. And you're not going to fit into this organization. You're going to struggle with it. So we encourage people to reflect on themselves and look at their own views and stereotypes and paradigms about other people and to let go wherever possible. To be able to change and to embrace a culture like this rather than to stand up for yourself and become an individual.
What the listeners can't certainly see, but what I'm seeing you do is this flowing through. And I would associate that with an Eastern philosophy of energy flowing. But yes, there's exactly that everything needs to flow through. And if you don't allow it to leave you, you're going to be stuck with it and then you become rigid and immovable and potentially unusable as a citizen in your organization, certainly. The other thing that I really like from what you've said is people aren't always going to be happy, but if they feel safe and if they feel comfortable, they're going to perform.
So that would lead us on to our third pillar, which is servant leadership.
Okay.
Okay, so that's about serving people. Because the whole philosophy of the business is about serving people, we felt that our leadership also needs to be about serving people.
Mm.
So it's really about serving the people who are serving the people.
Mm.
That's the philosophy of servant leadership. And that's also about creating a working environment and growing people from the bottom up rather than, the control
command
and control style of management, which holds people down, where you work on fear rather than respect.
How do you serve in the servant leadership style without being walked all over?
Yes, okay. So it's not a soft approach. I think people just assume because you're serving that you have become subservient.
Mm.
That's not the case. Mm. You're serving people, in fact, just to help them to become better servers in their own right. So that means that you have to, train and develop all the normal things that you do, but you are helping this person to grow, not for your benefit, but for theirs. And I think that's very important. Most people think that they train people for the benefit of the company, but it's not so in my view. You're training people for their own benefit, and if they benefit the company, well, that's a reward. That's not the purpose.
Mm.
And you need to grow people and to touch the lives. So when you're talking about touching lives, it's not only about our guests, it's about our citizens as well. And making them better people and more skilled, more experienced, more knowledgeable, so that they can go out and serve their guests even better. So it's all about service, and it's a flow of service from the leadership all the way through. Whereas in most companies, the staff are kind of subservient to their managers, and they look up to them, and they grovel and they bow, and they because the managers are controlling their lives and their destinies and all that.
If you do not, you will.
They're more concerned about keeping the managers happy than they are about keeping the customers happy.
Mm.
And we kind of turn that around. So the leaders now must help the citizens to be able to serve their guests to the very best of their ability.
All the while not throwing the baby out with the bathwater by not performance managing, by not doing any of those things. So that's all part of it.
So the discipline will always stay.
Yes, yes.
You know, this is not an ill-disciplined approach. Mm. It's just a serving approach. But all the disciplines, if somebody steps out of line, they're going to go into a disciplinary hearing the same as any other company. Mm. But the style of leadership is different. It's just trying to get people to grow and to nurture them as they grow and to start making people believe that they don't have a ceiling above their heads.
You know,
we like to see our salon assistants, who are the ones who clean and make tea in the business, and watch them grow and give them opportunities to learn how to become a nail technician and to improve their lives and their financial income, etc., etc. So the whole thing is about upliftment all the time, uplifting people.
You know what's remarkable is I was with Frans van der Kolff a little while ago. He's the let's call him the master mind. Yes, you'll like correct. That title behind Food Lovers Market. Mm. And his background was in pick and pay, also retail. And he just told a story about a shop assistant who wrote on his goals to own his own pick and pay. And Franz saw that and he decided to pull him up and through and do exactly what you're describing, which is serve, empower.
Yes.
But by doing that, he was empowering his own journey as well. Yes. And I love that idea. And the fact is, you sitting here across the table from me being quite successful, France sits wherever it is that we interact, successful, and what you have in common is this idea of servant leadership, which is fantastic. Thank you. Your final pillar.
The final pillar is passionate service.
Okay.
So we take service to a slightly different level. If somebody's not happy, we have a sign in our store that says, if you're not happy with your treatment, you don't have to pay. I've been to several hundred salons in South Africa and all over the world. I've never seen a sign like that.
Mm.
People just don't do that because they're afraid that you're going to be abused and everyone's going to take advantage of you. No one's ever going to pay.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, you know, is that it's very, very small. A very, very small percentage of people ever abuse that thing. We do, on average, about 300,000 treatments a month at the moment in Sorbet. And we have maybe 50 complaints.
That's remarkable.
You know, so it's very small in relation to the number of treatments we do. And even with products, if somebody brings a product back and it's half used, most people will say, "Look, forget about it. Why didn't you bring it back straight away?
Sure.
Where's your slip? Where's your where's your life? And how do you want me to refund you something that you've been using for 6 months or whatever?"
Exactly.
But we'll take it back. And we'll say to the person, "No problem, you know." And if you think about it, people say, "Well, that's crazy. Why would you do that?" And it's quite simple, really. At the end of the day, if you're going to refund somebody 500 rand and they're going to become a loyal guest of yours for the next 5 years, we work out they're going to bring about 30,000 rand in over the next 5 years. So it's a very simple equation, and it's a very cheap investment.
I learned this lesson from the CEO, the founder of a fairly large forex business, which is an interesting business to learn from, or interesting leader to learn from, where he just said that what you really just need to do is look at the life expectancy of your, so to speak, of your guest or your client, your customer, and they're going to bring in multiples if you just treat them right and do what's right. Thank you for that particular lesson. We are running out of time, it seems.
Okay,
we just got a signal.
Okay.
Let's do some quick fire questions and then round this all off. What is the absolute worst advice in your entrepreneurial journey that you've ever received?
Make as much money as you can as quickly as possible, because that never works.
Never works.
Never works.
When did you realize it doesn't work? I know you shared that experience, but there must have been a couple of others where you were chasing that or following that advice, but just didn't realize what the advice was potentially trying to promote.
Yeah, I think it's about short-term thinking as opposed to long-term thinking. Mm. That's the thing. So if you're thinking about the short-term and how much money you can make in the short-term, then you start making decisions that are not in the best interest of your guests, and that's always a problem.
And the guests ultimately are telling you whether your business is working or not, your customers. Correct. The customer is always right, as you said.
Exactly.
They are the great feedback mechanism that will tell you how to run your business successfully.
And if you're coming back, and we've got 400,000 loyalty members now, you know, if they keep coming back, then you're obviously doing something right.
Yeah, exactly. And then it does start with listening. So let me continue listening here. What is the best advice you've ever received?
That one that I spoke about, the, you know, that the purpose of work is to serve. That really changed my entire life as far as my business career is. It changed everything, my view on how to lead, how to manage, how to grow a business. Everything is about purpose. And there's a great book for people to read. It's called Start With Why by Simon Sinek. And he talks about the importance of understanding why you're in business. And this is, you know, right up our alley. So it's all about, for us, it's about touching lives.
The why. I want to support it with two quotes that I love. One of them is from Simon as well.
Yes.
But the one quote, which isn't from him, is, "Tell me sufficiently why I ought to do a thing, and I will move heaven and earth to do it."
Yeah.
That phrase or that quote has fundamentally changed my approach personally in everything that I do. And then there's another one from Simon, which says, your job as a leader is not to understand the what of the question.
Yeah.
It's to understand why the question was asked in the first place, which is a really great quote. You've already answered the question what book we should be reading.
Okay.
Maybe then just a final question from our side, which we ask everyone that comes through that door. And if you could go back in time and talk to the young 20-year-old future CEO you, what would you say to you?
I think you must understand that there are three sort of basic characteristics that you need to, you know, to be in business and to grow, whether you're a CEO, a budding CEO, or you're an entrepreneur. And that is that you need intuition first. You need to have some sort of intuition, and you can't have a fear of failure. Okay, fear of failure doesn't go down well if you're in a leadership position, because you're going to be making decisions every day of your life that's going to either work or not. And if you're afraid to fail, you're going to probably not make half of those decisions. But you need intuition, which is the sense that something is right, even though you don't have the evidence to prove it. And then you need courage, because there will be times when you know, people are losing their heads all around you, and you've got to keep yours and you've got to keep going. And then finally, determination to see it through. And it's a journey. It's never an incident. It's a journey in life, to build a business. It takes time, and you grow over that period. So if you have intuition, you're not afraid, you have courage of convictions, and you have determination to see it through, and for the long haul, I think you'd be in good shape.
Mr. Ian Furr, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here in studio with us, sharing your journey, sharing your insights. We've run out of time, which means we're probably going to have you back here at some point. But thank you so very much for being here. And we certainly wish you all the best as you push forward. And I'm certainly excited to see where you're going next.
We have five stores in London already.
Oh, really? Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, we've started there. Yeah.
Well, we're going to be looking on with much interest. And when the globe is yours, we'll have you back in studio and you can share a whole new set of lessons from playing in the global playground.
Thank you very much, Gareth. I appreciate it, and I've enjoyed our chat.
That is all we have time for this week on Future CEOs. We'll see you same time, same place next week.
This is CliffCentral.com.